Cultivating Place is made possible in part through the generosity of the Cato Shaw Foundation. This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. In this first episode of March, when the early signs of spring are stirring in our pots, in our landscapes, in our dreams, I'm so pleased to kick off Women's History Month in conversation with a notable woman of the international horticultural world, Jekka McVicker. Often known as the Queen of Herbs in her home country of the United Kingdom, Jekka has worked with herbs since 1985, and in recognition of her herbal research, plant breeding, and advocacy around the many merits of all manner of herbs to the gardened world this past 40 years, she has been awarded the Victoria Medal of Honor in Horticulture by the Royal Horticultural Society, and the Gardeners Media Guild Lifetime Achievement Award. She has as well been decorated with more than 60 Royal Horticultural Society gold medals. At Jekka's herb farm and herbedum in South Gloucestershire, she displays her life's collection of close to 600 culinary, medicinal, pollinator-supporting, and beautiful herbs. I was honored to profile Jekka in my 2020 book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants, as one of the women leaders in our horticultural world who have expanded and elevated the way we think and talk about gardening. Jekka, it is such an immense pleasure to welcome you to Cultivating Place.
Good evening in the UK.
This is partly why it is an even greater pleasure to speak with you in the deep, dark, cold stretches of winter where we are in the world, and in what is sort of a trying time period. Even like getting ready for this interview, Jekka, to read again about your herbal work, to read the newest book you have out, these 100 herbs to grow, I felt better. Just thinking about it and reading about it, I felt better. But I'm going to stop talking and I'm going to ask you to describe for listeners what you do as your, like, you know, 2-minute introduction to a new person. What do you do, Jekka?
Well, Jennifer, you are so lovely. What do? I am a herb farmer. I start at about 6:30 every morning, and I grow over 586 different herbs. They're in peat-free compost. I've always been organic, but it didn't start like that. It actually started in my back garden in cold frames that we made out of our wardrobe. You know, and we supplied Fortnum's. So this beautiful book you're introducing is actually going to be launched at Fortnum's because it's 30 years since I supplied Fortnum's as a wholesale grower. When my children were tiny and I strapped them in the front of my van and I drove them to London to deliver the plants. Can you imagine? It is just... the whole world has changed about how plants are grown, what we grow, who we are, health and well-being. I mean, this is where my focus has been for the last, and it's going to be in March, 40 years. I've been growing herbs for 40 years.
You know, and it's, to be honest, it's actually well over 40 years. I mean, you began doing what you do well before you landed that contract at Fortnum and Mason. And the, for listeners who might not be familiar with that, that grocery marketing, high-end supply, like mecca for food lovers, specifically in London and England, but around the world for those people that are really dedicated to this kind of purveyor in our world. So before we get
to there. I want to go back even further, Jekka. You've said several things that we're going to highlight throughout this conversation. The importance of organics, the importance of environment, the importance of healthy food first, before we're even talking about the beautiful aesthetics. But before we dive into all of that herbal goodness, take us back. Where were you born and raised? Who were the people and places and plants that grew you into a woman who would take over your suburban house and load your kids in a car full of herbs to drive into the city? Like, take us back to the very beginning.
Okay, darling. I am seriously old. So you're going back to the 1950s now. And I'm in a lovely house in a village called Chumagna, which is just outside Bristol. And my mother, because it's the 50s, had a totally sustainable garden. We ate the garden. And we're going to have to do that again now. But that's what she did. So I grew up being able to pick the herbs for her. I was the eldest. And so I always was the one that was sent out to choose chives, French parsley. No, I want French parsley today, not curly parsley. I want apple mint, not spearmint. So I knew the difference before I went to school. And we had beautiful wooden seats that I would turn backwards so that I could then kneel on the seat and then chop my herbs on the table. And she had a wooden table and wooden chopping boards. And, you know, just like young Jamie has taught his son to chop early, I was taught to chop right from the word go. And you can use a knife correctly if you're taught. And that's how I was taught, and that's how I was brought up to be totally sustainable.
Yeah. And I recall from our earlier conversations, Jekka, that this was, you know, ingrained in you from when you were little, but it was when you became a mother that the importance of feeding your children as well as you had been fed, despite the mainstream pressure to have things be easier or more convenient or more processed or pick it up at the Sainsbury's.
You're absolutely correct. And even tonight, before I sat down to talk to you, I cooked the evening meal for my husband and myself. It is ingrained into me to cook and to cook with fresh ingredients. And it's been scientifically proven now that if you do not add additives, if you do not buy ready meals, if you use herbs and use natural product to produce the meal, you are much healthier.
So speaking of your, as you describe him, long-suffering husband, Mac, take us to the point where you as a young mom and spouse to Mac begin producing herbs, not just growing herbs for your own family's meals.
My darling husband was launching satellites off Wallops Island when I was first married. And it was the last UK satellite. And I went to that. And I ate your amazing fish. Oh, my goodness. I'd never had soft-shell crabs. I mean, whoa. You have such a diverse and amazing food. But when I came back to the UK and we started our family, he was then sent off to France to launch another satellite. So I went with my family, my newly born son and my daughter, and off we trotted off to France. And so there was a whole new gambit of herbs. But when I came back, I realized I needed to work, but I didn't want to leave the children. So I started the herb farm around them. And we built cold frames out of our wardrobes And it was from those cold frames that I supplied Fortnum's. And, you know, if you think about it, I bought the veg man's van. And out of that tiny semi-detached house, I don't know if you have semi-detached houses in America.
Here we call them a duplex.
That's a house attached to another house. You live in one half, they live in the other. And you've just got to hope you get on with your neighbors because you can hear.
And that everyone's sort of quiet most of the night. Okay, wait. But tell listeners the herb that launched it all in a way, because I think they will love that story.
It was French tarragon. Because I was there growing all these herbs and a girlfriend of mine came in and said, I'm doing an Elizabeth David recipe. I don't know if you know Elizabeth David as a cookbook writer in the USA, but she is amazing. And I said, and she said, I need some French tarragon. I said, help yourself. And I thought, wow, I grow that. I can easily grow that. And no one sells it. And my father was retail, and on my birth certificate, he says he's a haberdasher, but that's ironic. And he taught me that if you could find something that no one else did, you had a business. And I found that, and I was very, 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 very lucky that in the 80s that I started the herb farm. Because I was before the crest of the wave. I chose to be organic. I chose to be sustainable because of the children. They were one and two when I started, and I didn't want them getting into any chemicals. I didn't want them being hurt if I answered the phone to someone or I went to the door. And so that was my choice. And I'd read Anne Balfour's book about the Soil Association, and I was really hooked into sustainability then. And this is the 80s, and people are now catching up. And yesterday, I had a visit from the Royal Horticultural Society because I've been peat-free here for over 30 years. That's growing my plants in peat-free compost. And they're now asking all the floral exhibitors, which I was, to go peat-free. And some of them are finding it incredibly difficult. But it's all a matter of mind and how you look at plants and how you learn how to grow plants that makes it feasible.
Right. And, you know, I want to go back to the crest of the wave comment. I mean, many of us would say you actually created that wave. You were the mother of that wave, and you are frequently referred to as the queen of herbs. And you know, that early emphasis, Jekka, I think cannot be overstated of yours to the importance of herbs as good food, herbs as good medicine, but also herbs as this foundation to environmental sustainability. Like one of your early, I think your first, I might be getting this a little bit wrong, but you know, many of your displays at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show include the importance of these kinds of plants, which have been traded among humans for thousands of years across the globe. And so, you know, adapted for long periods of time, even in places where they might not be native, as fantastic pollinator support. And in this time when our native plants and our biodiversity is so high on our mind, the importance of even these Mediterranean herbs here where I am in Northern California as really valuable pollinator nectar support, you can't do better than that. And so learning from those to then maybe identify your native herbs that would add to that, like it's just a perfect combination of why the human impulse to garden is epitomized in the herb garden.
I think the herb garden is the foundation. If you think about it, before the word vegetable was invented in, I think it was 1677, don't hold me to that. It could be 1766 at the moment, I'm so tired. But it's modern, if you think the word vegetable is quite actually modern in the word of language, before that, everything was called a pot herb. Now, again, if you actually stop to think, all our ancestors in the USA and in the UK actually put herbs and what we would call herbs today in the pot, and it was the one pot over the open fire. They didn't have the sort of, if you like, I've got a hob and everything else. They didn't have any of that. They didn't have three pans going at the one time. They had one pot. And that gave the name to pot herbs. So it's our history. It's our ancestry. And it's our whole being that herbs are the foundation of our medicine, our health, and our well-being. And it is not just well-being for us, but also for the planet. Because as you so rightly said, the Lamiaceae family are the best for pollinators that you could possibly have. So by growing herbs, they look good, do you good, and do the planet good. And I don't know there's another group of plants that gives so much to us today.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. To kick off Women's History Month, we're speaking this week with Jekka McVicker of Jekka's Herb Farm and Herbedum in the United Kingdom. This year marks 40 years of Jekka's notable contributions to our botanical and gardened world, as well as the publication of her newest compendium, 100 Herbs to Grow, a comprehensive guide to the best culinary and medicinal herbs. We'll be right back for more with Jekka after a quick break. Stay with us. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by the Cato Shaw Foundation, funding initiatives that empower women and help preserve the planet through the intersection of environmental advocacy, social justice, and creativity. Hey, it's Jennifer. Jekka may be the queen of herbs, but surely herbs, in all their range and variety, are the royalty of the plant domain. Their magic, their medicine, their magnetism, pulling in and also supporting all manner of life above and below ground. My very first little square of dirt allotted to me by my mother, I designed and planted as a little herb garden at 8,000 feet on the Front Range of Colorado. I can't remember now if my mother steered me this way or if I came up with the idea through some other inspiration. What I do know is that sage, mint, and thyme, all hardy in Zone 4, high elevation Colorado, were featured in this childhood design, and they companion me even now. When we think about it, we offer herbs to other humans and to ourselves throughout our lives. We offer them to delivering mothers, to their delivered newborns. We offer them at weddings and funerals and most of life's other notable corporeal thresholds. We drink and smudge, steam and seed forward in relationship with herbs thousands of years in the intertwining and interrooting. It's amazing when you think of it, isn't it? The history of mint or sage or thyme and us. Amazing. We're back now to our Women's History Month conversation with Jekka McVicker of Jekka's Herb Farm and Herbetum. Jekka has a notable 40-year career growing with herbs, and on March 4th, her newest book, 100 Herbs to Grow, a comprehensive guide to the best culinary and medicinal herbs, will be out from Quadrille Press. Let's define some terms. What is an herb?
A herb is any plant that is of benefit to man, according to the Oxford Dictionary. So that can be a fruit. So, for example, lemon and orange are herbs, and pomegranate is certainly a herb. It can be a vegetable. For example, beetroot is a herb. Yeah, it's an extremely good antioxidant and really hugely beneficial, both leaf and root. And it is a herb when you have things like aloe vera.
Okay. What is an herbetum, however you say it?
A herbetum.
Yes.
I've created a herbetum here. And the reason was I was in a very important meeting and I was looking around the room and there was a gentleman there who had an arboretum. And there was another gentleman there who had a vineetum. And there was another gentleman who had a national collection of galanthus. And then there was me, herb farmer. I thought, what does etum mean? Because it's a suffix. So I thought, what does etum mean? So I looked it up. Shows how bored I was in the meeting. And it means a collection of. So when you have an arboretum, it means a collection of trees. When you have a roseetum, it means a collection of roses. A vineetum, a collection of vines. So I thought, right, I'm here. I'm going to have a herbetum. So I had a herbetum, which means a collection of herbs. So I've laid it out round my glasshouse, which is where I do all my propagation. And on one side, it's the Lamiaceae family. Now, if you don't understand plant families, my new book is brilliant at that.
Yes, it is. We'll get to that.
It is really important because you look like your family. So I've got dark eyes. I did have dark hair. It's now gray. But my son and daughter both have dark eyes. And so it's a hereditary thing. So when you look at the Lamiaceae family, they all have square stems, nearly all of them, 90%. And they all have flowers where the tongue of the lower lip sticks down like a tongue. It was called Labiatae, now it's called Lamiaceae. And it actually, once you understand that and you understand that sage, thyme, oregano, lavender, rosemary, bergamot are all the same family, then you understand how to grow them. And it's really important to actually comprehend plant families. So Asteraceae is the daisy family, and that has masses of plants. I mean, absolutely, it's the biggest family of the lot. But then Myrtaceae, which is my myrtle family, there are not so many. So you understand how to grow them because they all belong to that group of plants and they all behave in the same kind of way. They're herbaceous, not herbaceous, shrubs, not shrubs, and so on, subshrubs. I get far too excited by the whole thing.
But you're right. It gives us this easy shortcut and access point to understanding some preliminary basics, and it helps in identifying. It also really helps. I was noticing this as I was looking through the book, the importance of knowing the botanical name so that you can identify which ones you're speaking about. So, for instance, you give us one suggested of the 100 herbs in this book is Artemisia, you give us a handful of species from the genus in the family, right? And what was important was that you gave us those specific names. You didn't just say mugwort, because mugwort, one of the common names for a handful of the different Artemisias, there is a specific one which is wildly invasive on the East Coast of the United States. If you just use the word mugwort, you label and burden the entire genus with this toxicity, when in fact only one of them is that wildly invasive and the rest of them are fabulous choices.
Like Artemisia jocunculus, my favorite one of all, French tarragon.
Yeah. So I think this is another, like that is one example of what you can gain by getting into your botanical Latin and these family associations more specifically.
I want to give you a story, Jennifer. I was taking people around. This is me very young. My first botanical tour, taking people around botanic gardens. I'm on a ship, okay? And I get off this ship, and because I'm last off, because I don't know the protocol, I land up on a broken down dormobile with a high RASDA. So he drives off. There are 13 of us, 12 customers and me. Okay, I have my clipboard. Off we go, and we immediately break down. In fact, we break down so badly that the chassis comes away from the wheel. Oh, anyway,
wow.
So I get everyone out of this dormobile, and everyone's freaking out, and we have no mobiles in those days. And I said, look, please don't worry. They counted us off. They'll count us back. I said, let's walk down the high street here, because we were in a little village. And there was this wonderful woman sitting outside her front door. And I said, look, ladies and gentlemen, sweet basil. She was sitting next door to the biggest pot of sweet basil I'd ever seen. And she rolls off her chair and says, ma'am, that's not sweet basil. That's lady's mint. Now, I knew enough about plants to know that basil and mint are the same family. So I went, oh, that's really interesting. What would you call sweet basil? And she produces a plant that I call Plectanthrus, which of course has just been reclassified as Coleus, but in my book it's Plectanthrus, Plectanthrus ambonicus. It is the most amazing plant. And it is used in Sri Lanka for chest complaints in children, but in the West Indies, it is eaten in Creole chicken. So I was absolutely fascinated that this one plant, the Latin changed. You know, from sweet basil, it became Plectanthrus, and my sweet basil became mint. So off we went, and we went to the next island. So we're going around a botanic garden. I'm young. I go, oh, look, ladies and gentlemen, here is sweet basil. And the guide said, oh, no, how stupid. No, this is Jamaican broadleaf thyme. It wasn't. It was still the Plectanthrus ambonicus.
Right. That's a perfect illustration right there.
Right there. Yes.
And the humor of it is also important, because we don't want to take ourselves too seriously, and we want to stay open to what other people's names and stories are. And that's where we grow and learn. But that Latin name gives us a direct association between are we talking about the exact same thing, and if not, how do we sort that out in a meaningful way? And there's, you know, in the herb world, where the lore and the knowledge is so deep and long, there's room for all of that.
There is, but there's also room if you want to take it medicinally. You need to know the botanical name.
Very good point.
I mean, I can't stress that enough. It becomes quite apparent, you know, when you travel, how you need to know what you're eating, and you need to know what you're taking medicinally. And hopefully with this book and with all the new resources that everyone's got, mistakes won't be made quite so much.
Definitely, yeah. So in 1994, your really big book, Jekka's Complete Herb Book, comes out. It's been a major success. You already
30 years.
I mean, it's impressive and sold many, 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 many copies. What was the catalyst for this book?
The catalyst for this new book really is how much has changed in 30 years. You may not be aware of climate change on a daily basis, but here at the herb farm, we are, because we've kept temperature records every day since I've been here for nearly 38 years here. And I started 2 years in Bristol. So it's 40 years. And this book celebrates the knowledge of 40 years, because when I wrote that after 10 years knowledge, I realized what this 30 years I'm adding to it is giving to this book. It's not just how the botanical names have changed, because we now have DNA. We didn't have DNA in plants in those days. We now have peat-free. I remember, you know, when I wrote about bark in my first book, everyone thought I was mad. You know, propagating bark. We can't buy propagating bark. Well, you can now, of course, in perfusion. It is also about how the plants actually historically affect us now. And it is more the now book than it was then. And I've cut down the varieties. There are 100 herbs. However, I do cheat just a bit.
A little bit.
Because I do grow 72 different types of thyme. But time is just one in this book.
I saw that little hack.
You saw that?
Yeah.
You saw my little cheat, did you? Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, and the same with lavender.
But
I have to cheat.
Yes, because it's so big. But what brought me to asking you about the catalyst for this book was your emphasis on the importance of understanding what you're doing, how you're doing it, and why you're doing it when using any plant for medicinal purposes. Tell listeners about the format for each profile.
Well, it is based on my original book, I have to be honest, because I thought that was so simple. And I emphasized to my first publisher why that had to be laid out like that. And sadly, my first publisher is my age, and she's retired, and she sold Carl, the first publisher, to another publisher. They didn't want to do this, you know, modernization of my original book. So I am blessed that Quadro did.
Yeah.
Because to me, that is just, well, it's so important to me to actually keep the next generation going and get them inspired in herbs as well. So basically, I start off with the name. If you look at the top, it's got the common name. But if you look, the main headline is in Latin. I make no apology. Goes into the history, the species, how to propagate it. Because again, propagation has changed over with climate change. And so that's totally changed. Cuttings, division, pests and disease, how to grow and where to grow, growing in containers, which is becoming more important. I mean, listeners, do you grow herbs in containers? I can hear a few of you saying yes.
Yes.
So if you do, then have you fed them this week? No, you haven't. Okay. From March the 1st, you must feed them weekly. They have no source of food if they're in a container. So I feed on Fridays, F for food, F for Friday, F for feed.
What do you feed your potted herbs? And is it different by type? Or give us a little bit of an overview since we're there right now.
It's not different by type.
Okay.
It's like my potting compost. My substrate is the same across the board because they're grown in pots. And when you water, your water is normally pretty alkaline. So even if you've got an acid-loving plant, it equals out. People don't realize that. but I feed on Fridays with a liquid seaweed fertilizer. Because seaweed is like comfrey, it's high in magnesium and minerals, and that's what the plants look for. If you've got a plant in a garden, it's been scientifically proven that the roots talk to each other. So in my herb garden, I've got Mr. Bay. Hello, I'm Mr. Bay. And next door to it, and sort of a little bit sort of out of the lee of it, I have got some beautiful Salvia viridis valcomota growing. And the Salvia viridis valcomota, being an annual, is slightly feeling a bit fragile. Oh, Mr. Bay, I need more minerals. Where do I find them? Left a bit, down a bit, right a bit. And then they find the minerals. And it's absolutely fascinating how that works. And I was talking to a lady from Japan, literally this week. And what she does is she puts a chimney into her soil, but not all the way down. And the lower half of her soil, she digs a pit about a meter, if you've got it, or 40 centimeters deep. And then she throws her kitchen waste, not anything woody and not meat or bones and not eggshells, down this chimney, puts a lid on the top, and that rots down and that feeds the roots through the same system that I've just explained. So feeding your garden is so important, and feeding your plants, especially when you're cropping it.
Now, why not eggshells, Jekka?
They don't break down
fast enough. So even if you like crack them up into little pieces and...
They don't break down.
Okay.
They take years to break down.
Okay, good. So I want to reiterate what you just told us about the format, and especially highlighting the things that I loved about this. You give a wide variety of common names. As far as I can tell, you give every common name you can find in what people use for each plant. And I love that.
I've found over the last 30 years, yeah.
Yeah. And that's in a rather small and unassuming type. And then you have the big, bold, actual name. And one of the things I love about this is I know gardeners are smart and I know we work hard. So having been spoken down to for way too long in our gardening press and media sometimes, I don't know a gardener who isn't happy to read up to this level. And I love that you assume that of us and we are fine with it. I love the stories you offer for your experience with each one. And then the history, the propagation is so useful, how to grow in containers. And then all of this about how to harvest and store, how to use in cooking, how to use in medicine. And then for those that might need it, you also include warnings about toxicity, warnings about known allergens, warnings about very invasive problems in different areas. And I am very appreciative.
Thank you, Jennifer. I do. I really do. But I know that I will have missed some.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I've tried my absolute best, but I've also given you under each herb the USDA zone. Mm-hmm. I've written that in this time on each herb so that you know which zone it grows in.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. We're speaking this week with Jekka McVicker of Jekka's Herb Farm and Herbedom in the United Kingdom. Her newest work, 100 Herbs to Grow, a comprehensive guide to the best culinary and medicinal herbs, is out this month from Quadrille Press. We'll be right back for more with Jekka after a quick break. Hey, it's Jennifer again. So right now, I'm getting over my very first round of COVID. I know it. It took me long enough, right? In my recovery, I am offering the virus and my immune system herbs. Yep, herbs, by way of sipping on a steaming cup of herbs from my emerging winter garden. A stem each of thyme, rosemary, and oregano. A fresh tip of early growth mint and one kumquat from the tree which grows by my front door and which my sisters gave me as a housewarming present
10 years ago now. These finish off my remedy tea. It is bright green and fragrant in the cup, and altogether it almost makes COVID feel festive. Almost. In this late winter, early spring time of year, with the vernal equinox in sight now, what are your go-to comfort and medicine herbs for your mind, body, and heart? Do they speak back to your own family, your place, your culture? I'd love to hear and share your stories and thoughts on this topic. It is such an ancient one for us as gardeners. Send me an email if something comes to mind, or leave a comment on this week's post over at Instagram. You know my email, but I'll tell you again, cultivatingplace@gmail.com. And over on Instagram, you can find me at cultivating_place. We can share the fragrance and fortitude of these plants we love to live with together. We're back now to our Women's History Month conversation with Jekka McVicker of Jekka's Herb Farm and Herbetum. As we come back, she shares so much more about the many benefits of herbs in our gardens and in our lives. How in heaven's name did you narrow it down to 100? And we know you did more than 100, but how did you narrow it down from 586 species you grow? And I'm assuming, for the most part, love and have experience with. What were your metrics? What was really important for you?
The reason I whittled it down was to what I thought, one, people would use,
yep,
or wanted to know about. Two, what could excite them to go to the next level? So there are a few in there which you won't know, which I've put in because I'm going, well, come on, let's go this way as well. To make people realize that even though I'm not growing herbs from that, they're not from my climate, but actually they adapt to my climate. And is that a bad thing when we're told to only grow indigenous plants? Well, actually, sometimes growing those without heat, but growing them correctly, really is a benefit to man. And to inspire people to garden. Now, Jennifer, are you a gardener or a horticulturalist?
I am a gardener. I have always been a gardener. I am unapologetically a very generalist home gardener, Jekka.
Whereas I am an appalling gardener.
And I don't believe that.
I am a horticulturalist. Oh, I am. Because I love I get sidetracked by the minute. And that's what a horticulturalist is. I'm always looking at, oh my goodness, look at that seedling. Look at how that one's reverted. Oh, that's come through. How do I propagate this? You know, that's my world.
Well, okay, if that's the definition, then I'm probably both, because I can't drive down a side road without being like, John, stop the car. Wait, did you see that? And that's the great fun. That's the great fun.
But that is it. Today I saw a primrose.
Oh,
it is January.
That's very early.
I was driving to pick up my dog because she goes to play school on Fridays, and there was a primrose in flower. I was talking to a neighbor and I said to him, look, we're in the middle of the country, down a country lane. There's a primrose in flower on January the 26th. Whoa, that's early. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I want to have you offer out to listeners, and you've already given a few. We've already touched on French tarragon. We've already touched on the great joys of the large genus that we know as lavender, and the joys of the mint family and the daisy family. Maybe give us a couple of examples of those that you added in to surprise and compel people in new and wider directions, Jekka.
Okay, there's one recently that I've got hugely excited about. It's used by the northern tribes of China. And I don't know if you grow it in the USA, but I'm pretty darn sure you will. It's known as sweet vine, tea vine, or I call it jangalang, and it's Gynostemma pentaphyllum, is the Latin.
Mm.
And this is a fascinating herb from China. It is also used in Vietnam and Korea, but it's known as the immortal herb. But it's, for people of my age, it's really good as a tea, sweet vine tea, for helping with toxicity in our bodies.
Mm.
And it's a member of the cucumber family. I mean, I just find that wonderful. And when you try a leaf, you go, oh my gosh, so it is. It tastes like cucumber. Yeah, it's just amazing. I do put in a warning on the site because it can stimulate the immune system. So it must, if you're taking other drugs with it, do be careful. But I find that the tea, if I'm feeling sort of worn out and it's in the high season and I'm busy, I will make a fresh tea. It's worth trying. I haven't dried it yet because I go for lemon verbena when I can. But it is just wonderful.
So do you make a tea of just the fresh leaves?
Fresh leaves, yeah. It also lowers high blood pressure.
I have never heard of this one. How is it growing there in Bristol?
It's a vine. At the moment, it's herbaceous.
Okay.
So it's died down. It grows like my hops. It grows really, really fast. So if you've got a trellis, you can grow it up. Very hardy. I found it actually to be, it's your USDA 8 and 9.
Okay. So
hardy.
Yeah.
4 in the UK. So it's a hardy plant. It really is something worth growing if you want to. Well, one, I add the leaves to salads as well, thinking, well, I might make him live another 2 years. we've been married 48 years, so yeah, could do with another 2 years. I'd like to make the 50.
Okay. All right, I'll go with that. And I see that if you want seeds, you need to have both a male and a female, a stem and
yeah,
engine.
I would try and find someone that's got a really, it's rhizomous.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So it's really worth these. It's so easy to propagate.
Okay.
Another one, which you might not know, which I'm really fascinated by, and I'm fascinated by the future of this plant, is linum.
Yes, the flax plant. Yeah.
Limon is linseed flax.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's where we've got our linen from. I feel that there's a huge future in this plant. And it's eustaticism.
I love that you just stumbled on that. Everybody out there is going, all right, that's so great. That yeah, not just us, right?
And linum perenni is the perennial, which right. is what people grow for gardens. But this is the seed, of course. Linum seed is scientifically proven for everything.
Everything.
It's essential for your gut.
Yeah.
Everyone's all about guts and how gut health is important.
I have had it referred to me by my primary care doctor as a fantastic supplement for a woman of 58 to help, you know, support my system.
You sproglet.
Yeah.
You're a sprog.
I will take that. Thank you.
I'm going to be 73 next week.
Happy birthday in advance.
So, you know, it is really, there's a long history of it and the use of treatment of cancer. And when I created that hospice garden at Chelsea Flower Show, were all the specialists who saw the garden, because I had linum growing in it, all of them said, if there's one herb anyone could grow to keep themselves well, this is the herb they need.
That's a beautiful recommendation. And that actually takes us in a beautiful way to that garden that you did. I believe it was 2016 you did that garden.
The Modern Apothecary.
Will you tell listeners about that garden, who it was for, and how it went on to be reinstalled, Jekka?
I just heard that my best friend's daughter had died. from a brain tumor, brain hemorrhage. Yeah, totally out of the blue. And I went to the funeral and I had to go to the interview at this hospice after to see if they'd sponsor me for Chelsea Flower Show. And when I went to the hospice, it was so beautiful. And the space they were giving was wonderful. And the sponsors were amazing. And it's St. John's Hospice. It's called Elizabeth and John the Hospital. And St. John's Hospice is attached to it. And they treat everyone in that area for free. It's a private hospital, but they treat the hospice people free. It's opposite the synagogue. So it's near Abbey Road. So if ever you go to Abbey Road, if you walk back up towards the tube, you will actually, if you look left, you'll see my garden. It was really dramatic to grow. And everything in the garden had a medicinal use. I had a yew hedge. I had Crataegus, hawthorn to me. I grew up as a child eating hawthorn leaves because they make your heart strong. And that's now been scientifically proven. It was called bread and cheese in my day. And everything I planted in that garden, it was all about circles as well. Because if you're in a low mood, you look at your feet when you're walking. And Steiner said, the last thing you want in a garden, if you're in a low mood, is to have to make a decision whether you go left or right. So I made sure that it was circular. But in the hospice garden, as opposed to the Chelsea garden, I put two circles in, three circles. I have the inner circle, then I have the outer circle at Chelsea, and then I had an outer circle because I wanted the beds to come out of the hospice, like Florence Nightingale said, fresh air is better than anything. And it made people feel part of the community. And can you imagine if you're stuck in a ward and then you could feel the fresh air on your face and you could smell the lavender, you could watch the butterflies. And I had a bird bath so that the people could actually see the birds coming to drink water. And when I was building the garden there on site, there was a lovely woman who was dying. And her family said to me after, the garden gave their mother a feeling that there was a tomorrow when she saw the garden.
This book does include some beautiful, kind of preliminary herb garden plans that people can use or adapt. And I love that.
You like them. You like my mad garden designs.
I love them. And and to follow up on that beautiful story that you just shared with us and how it illustrates the impact of gardens, but especially this kind of garden. I want you to also share with people a garden you have done for the living that made a difference, that was very powerful to you at the time that I spoke with you in 2018. And that was your St. Mungo, I think is the name of the organization, and Joe Malone collaboration on a garden called the Quiet Garden. Would you share about that one?
St. Mungo's, for those of you that don't know, is a charity for the homeless. And it came on a year after I'd done the hospice garden. And ironically, it was quite close by. And I'll never forget turning up the first day. It was in a park where the Notting Hill Carnival sets off when it goes in. And it was, as one of the locals says, the dog's loo. Everyone used to take their dog there to go to the loo. It was awful. I mean, it really was awful. And it was full of concrete. And I was given a crew of homeless people to work with me. And when I started, they looked down at their feet. After 3 months of working together, they were bouncing around the place, talking to the locals. The locals were bringing us ice melons because it was so hot to eat. It became part of the community. And there was one young man there who I won't use his name, but he used to go and say, "Hi, come look at this garden. Look what we're doing." And he used to show them around. And this is this, and this is this. And he was totally involved. It was absolutely awesome. But what you don't know is then 2 years later, 2019, I walk into sight at Chelsea Flower Show on the Sunday. And it's the sponsor's garden, which is M&G. And I hear this voice go, "Here, Jack, what are you doing? I'm here. I said I'd get to Chelsea." And the same guy who was homeless and helped me build that garden is now qualified in horticulture and was building a Chelsea gold medal garden.
Mm.
That garden totally inspired me. And recently here, in fact, it was last year, we converted part of the nursery into a herb garden here. And we used St. Mungo's Bristol to help me sift the soil and plant the garden here. So it goes on, and it just shows the power of gardening, the power of communication, and the power of plants to heal not just the environment, but us, is just amazing.
My final question, if you had to choose five herbs that you would not garden without, like, because, you know, very few people have all the space in the world. If you had five that you want to be buried with, what are those five?
French tagum, which is asteraceae. Lemon verbena, which is verbenaceae. And then the rest would all be from my famous Lamiaceae family. So I'd have to have rosemary because I can have rosemary tea, and rosemary is just so useful. It's evergreen herb. And if you ever suffer from low mood in winter, it makes a really good uplifting tea. I would have to have a thyme. And the first time I bred, we haven't touched on this, but I've bred a lot of plants over the last 40 years. And I'd have to take Jekka's thyme with me because that was the first one I bred. And it's now gone worldwide and I'm so chuffed with it. It grows in every circumstance and has the most beautiful flower here in the UK in May. Just wonderful. It's a low-growing, it's a moundy one, and it's just the most beautiful flower. I'd have to have an oregano, and I'd most probably go for Origanum dictamus, the Dittany of Crete, because that saved my life when I was a hippie. And... I'd have to have an allium. Hey, how many have I had? I'd have to have an allium of some kind. So I guess I would go not for chives, I would go for garlic chives, Allium tuberosum, because it flowers later, it flowers in July, but it's got a flat leaf, which isn't herbaceous. And so you can go on picking even now in the winter. So, how am I doing? Oh, and have I got a sage? I'd have back to Lamiaceae, Salvia lavendulifolia, which is the tiny leaf sage from Spain, because that is so good. And I could use it to try and keep the old gray cells working because it's very good for memory.
Okay. You have received so many accolades and medals. I think 62 RHS gold medals and many, many well-deserved accolades and medals. And I just want to say from myself and all the gardeners listening, and the bees and the environment and humanity at large, thank you for your work, Jekka, and thank you for your time on the program today. It has been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Cultivating Places.
Jekka McVicker has worked with herbs since 1985. In recognition of her herbal research, plant breeding, advocacy, and garden design, with the many merits of all manner of herbs these past 40 years, she has been awarded both the Victoria Medal of Honor in Horticulture by the Royal Horticultural Society and the Gardeners Media Guild Lifetime Achievement Award. At Jekka's Herb Farm and Herbedum in South Gloucestershire, she displays her life's collection of more than 600 culinary, medicinal, pollinator-supporting, and beautiful herbs. I was honored to profile Jekka in my 2020 book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants, as just one of the women leaders in our horticultural world who have expanded and elevated the way we think and talk about gardening. Join us again next week when we head to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to learn more about the history and mission of the Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park in conversation with Steve LeWare, Vice President of Horticulture there in Grand Rapids. That's next week, right here. Listen in. Cultivating Place is a co-production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio, licensed to Chico State Enterprises. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by listeners just like you through the support button at the top of every page at cultivatingplace.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. Cultivating Place is also made possible through the generosity of the Cato Shaw Foundation. The Cultivating Place team includes producer and engineer Matt Fidler, tech and web support from Angel Hiracha, weekly show transcripts by Doulis Transcription, and communication support by Deanna Newpert and Matt Valiga. We're based on the traditional and present homelands of the Machupta Indian tribe of the Chico Rancheria. Original theme music is by Ma Muse. Until next week, enjoy the cultivation of your place. I'm Jennifer Jewell.